Popmatic Podcast. It's the Groundhog Day episode. I am Brian, and joining me today are
Amanda,
Bill,
Mike,
Crystal,
and Amanda. Oh wait, sorry, Groundhog Day.
And I think I've heard this before.
Clint is in the booth.
Clint is here.
So actually, Groundhog Day is February 2nd, and in some Nowheresville town in Pennsylvania, they pull a greasy, disgusting rodent out of a hole, and this is supposed to be some important of weather to come. But we're the Library Pop Culture Podcast, so Groundhog Day to us means
Bill Murray.
Bill Murray, the 1993 Bill Murray vehicle where he plays a grumpy weatherman that gets stuck in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania on Groundhog Day. So we're going to feature books, movies, and music that we can watch over and over and over again, like we're caught in a loop, and we're okay with that. You know what? It's kind of just Scrooge Roommate. I'm not going to let me go there. But okay.
I like Scrooge. That's a good movie.
Scrooge is awesome.
I'm not dissing it.
Don't diss Scrooge.
I'm just saying.
Oh, get rowdy.
I'll cut you.
The arc.
I will cut you.
The arc that Bill Murray goes on in Groundhog Day is very similar to the arc in Scrooge, but hey, it's just a Christmas Carol. Okay. February is also what?
February.
African American History Month.
It is African American History Month. There's going to be all kinds of programs at the library, and I'll link to those so you can check them all out in the show notes. And we're going to do our best to work in African American History Month to Groundhog Day. It's going to be so much fun. You're going to be astounded. You're going to be speechless. Because when you think Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, you think African American History Month.
Okay.
You do a cold open?
I can cold open.
All right.
For Groundhog's Day, my first thought was talk about Gone with the Wind, because that's the book that I've read 9,472 times. But I always talk about that. So, and Crystal has beautiful music for me. Speaking of beautiful music, so instead I'm going to talk about the movie Sister Act, which stars Whoopi Goldberg, which ties in nicely to Brian's African American History Month. So see how nicely that worked? Sister Act came out in 1992, which is amazing that that film is 22 years old, provided I did my math right. And basically, if you haven't ever watched it, it stars Whoopi Goldberg as a gun moll from Reno, Nevada, witnesses a violent murder, goes into hiding in a convent, and then sings 60s and 70s go-go songs with new words. I didn't do a very good job describing that, but that's what it is. But the reason I keep going back to it, because it's an excellent sing-along movie, and that seems to be a theme with me. Like, I like Pitch Perfect, I like Glee. I love Sister Act because you can put it on, and you can be in your house, and you can be doing other things, like cooking or cleaning or something, and you know what's going to happen, and you can sing along to all these songs that everybody already knows, then you just change, like, two words, and you're there. So if you have not listened to Sister Act or watched Sister Act, we have it. Unfortunately, they did make a sequel, but we don't have that one anymore, which is sad because I almost like that one better, but both are good. You should watch them both over and over and over and over, and then one more time.
So does anyone know any nuns? Do you know how nuns feel about Sister Act?
I don't know. I have some great aunts that are nuns, but I haven't asked them.
They think it's nonsense.
Specifically. Well,
there's some that are patrons, and they come in.
Oh, yeah, we do have
them.
Yeah. I do have one fun fact for you, though. The older nun, Sister Mary Lazarus, who's kind of cranky and grouchy, I just found out that she's also the innkeeper in White Christmas, the one that finds out about the behind-the-scenes thing and almost wrecks the whole movie. So I did not realize that she was the same person, and that's very enjoyable.
She's also Hera, I think, in Clash of the Titans, which is pretty awesome. So when her head of the statue falls to the ground and she warns them to put Andromeda on the stone or I shall send the Kraken and stuff, that's pretty awesome.
Clash of the Titans is an awesome movie.
It's been too long since I've seen it.
I love Clash of the Titans. I used to watch it a lot as a kid.
It's not your turn yet. You can't talk about
it.
Oh, the enforcer.
Well, sorry, Sheriff Crystal.
It's Bill's turn.
In 1908, writer Robert Ludlum wrote a novel called The Bourne Identity, which begat The Bourne Supremacy and The Bourne Ultimatum. In 2002, Hollywood filmed The Bourne Identity, followed by The Supremacy and The Ultimatum, all starring Matt Damon. In 2012 came The Bourne Legacy, starring Jeremy Renner. To put it bluntly, I love the Bourne series. It's granted it's Hollywood entertainment, but it's great Hollywood entertainment. Usually movie series become dull and tiresome. Planet of the Apes or the Dirty Harry series are examples. They tend to lose their punch. However, with the Bourne series, it's the exact opposite. They get better with each film. And the last one, The Bourne Legacy, starring Jeremy Renner and Rachel Weisz, and directed by Tony Gilroy, I can't tell you how many times I've watched this movie. It's just smart storytelling, more realistic, less computer-generated. The Bourne movies always have top actors in them. For example, Edward Norton, Stacy Keach, Albert Finney, Scott Glenn, Brian Cox, Joan Allen, Julia Stiles, and Chris Cooper, just to name a few. The real sick aspect of all of this is that I own all the Bourne movies, but if I'm cable surfing and the Bourne movies are on, any of them, guess what? I'm going to watch it. And it happened just when we had that super cold day on a Monday, and I was there, it was on AMC with commercials, and I found myself watching The Bourne Identity again. So just to recommend all the Bourne movies, I personally love them and highly recommend them. I've seen them several times. Now, I have a quick trivia question. In 1988, they made The Bourne Identity into a miniseries for television. Who played Jason Bourne? At the time, he was called King of the Miniseries.
Richard Chamberlain?
That's right. Richard Chamberlain.
Yes. All right.
Richard Chamberlain, and I've tried to watch it, and I'm still waiting to get to the second half. It's not as good, and it'll probably be the one time I watch it. But the ones that they did in 2000 with Matt Damon, Jeremy Renner, highly recommend them.
I really like Shogun. Anyway.
Thorn Birds.
Yeah. Those are the two that I can name Richard Chamberlain in. So I guess he's the king because he's done two. Anyway, so this one was a bit trickier for me because, like, it seems like since, like, the DVD revolution and Netflix and things, it's like, now that I own this movie, I don't need to watch a repeat. Ha, 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 ha. It's like some weird Catch-22 thing. So I was thinking, I was like, well, every Easter, or I guess the day before Easter, I watch the Ten Commandments on ABC. Dun, dun, dun. And, or if I could say that. And it's...
What was the joke?
Back up, Brian.
I don't know. Where was the joke?
We'll have to bleep the network name.
Yeah.
ABC.
Am I allowed to name, like, you know, instances in which I may have watched
he
it?
He meant he checks out the movie from the library and watches it.
Of course, you know. I watch it by my... It's on Blu-ray, and it's on two Blu-rays. You have to, like, get up and change the Blu-ray halfway through for the intermission. Anywho, it's 3 hours and 40 minutes of biblical epic action. Well, not really action. Actually, if you want to go on YouTube, there's a really awesome, like, trailer that they splice that makes it look like a teenage, like, sex comedy. It is hilarious.
We should link to that.
Yeah. Send me the link to that.
I hope that's still there because, you know, it is awesome. Anyway. Basically, you know, if you haven't watched Ten Commandments, which you should have since it's been on since 1973, every Easter, it's basically the life of Moses starting from, you know, when he's a baby on the Nile to, you know, sometime when they're wandering the desert, you know, he dies off screen, which I guess is kind of nice. I like kind of separating it into sections. Like there's early Moses where he's like a prince, and then there's like Moses when he figures out that he's, you know, a Hebrew and he becomes a slave and stuff. And then there's, like, you know, the first exile, and then there's let my people go.
The sensitive guy with the beard.
Yeah, the bit where I just, you know, I kind of got him when he was like a dude and had, like, you know, problems and stuff. When he becomes like a prophet, I'm like, I can't really, like, relate to him anymore. You know, why are you telling me this, Moses? Because God said so. It's like, okay, you know. And then there's, like, you know, when they leave and, like, you know, the parting at the Red Sea, and it's all animated and cool, and you get to, like, see fish flop in, like, the sea and stuff. And it's like, cool. And as they're, like, riding by in chariots and stuff, you can see, like, you know, underwater animals and stuff. And then the water crushes, like, the armies of Egypt, and it's all cool.
I got that joke. That was funny.
Brian, obvious things. Anywho. I think it's really neat because, like, you know, I kind of miss those, like, old school epics where, like, you know, there's cast of thousands and everybody's got costumes and
that
Cecil B. DeMille,
I was gonna say, I
his very last movie. Yeah. And then I looked at a lot of, like, IMDb trivia today. And there's like there's a scene where like this old guy's like, you know, I'd like to go on Exodus with you guys, but I'm too old and feeble. And like this a muscular dude like picks him up and he's like, I'll help you out. You know, well, I'll go on, you know, leave Egypt together and stuff. And the little old dude played Jesus in The Greatest Story Ever Told in 1927.
Aww.
You know, it's wow. Like, oh, wow, Cecil B., like, you know, being loyal to his actors. And then the muscular guy apparently was like Mr. America or something. It's like, oh, good for him. And it's both like really glorious overacting and yet, you know, sometimes it can be really subtle acting, which I like. And last thing, Ridley Scott is making a new version of the Moses story called Exodus, starring Christian Bale as Moses, because Christian Bale has to be in everything.
Well, you're kidding, right?
No.
It's for real?
For reals.
I've seen photographs.
A follow-up to Prometheus?
Yes.
Yeah. Follow-up to The Counselor.
Wow. Let my people go.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. But I heard that isn't Russell Crowe playing Noah, too? I
mean, yes.
It's getting on.
I don't know which one Old Testament. Is scarier.
Yeah, it's so weird. It's like,
you're
going
to have to go sit outside in the cold for a while and ponder that.
Yes.
You know, maybe some fist fights in these biblical movies.
I'm
could watch that.
I'm traumatized by just the thought.
It'd be kind of cool.
Christian Bale, to me, is the dude from American Psycho.
Oh, yeah. Was it Patrick Bateman? Yeah.
Yeah. So, psycho, the most psycho of all psycho killers.
Have you also
the
heard?
Machinist. Oh. I forget the character's name, but I can't get either. That.
Have you guys heard they're making a musical out of American Psycho?
I have not heard that. I like that movie, American Psycho, but anyway.
I do too. Anyway, take it away, Crystal.
All right. So the books and movies and TV shows I revisit on a regular basis, most are ones that make me laugh. And that includes the movie I'm going to recommend today. Bonus, there are two versions of this film to enjoy. I'm talking about Death at a Funeral. The original British film was released in 2007, directed by Frank Oz. It's the story of a family who is coming together at the ancestral home to host a wake for the recently dearly departed patriarch of the clan. From the very first scene where the wrong body is delivered, Death at a Funeral is laugh out loud hilarious. It's got sibling rivalry, hypochondria, accidental ingestion of hallucinogenics, blackmail, nudity on the housetop, and finally, a lifelong family secret is revealed, and it's accepted without too much judgment. Some of my favorite actors make up the cast of this film. We've got Matthew McFadden, Rupert Graves, Alan Tudyk, mm-hmm. rocking a pretty fine accent, and Peter Dinklage, whom you may know from Game of Thrones. So when I heard Death at a Funeral was being remade, I was a tad bit furious. Why keep remaking films for starters, and especially one that's already in the English language? But I caved, and I eventually watched the American remake. And I must say, I enjoy it almost as much as the original. The 2010 version of Death at a Funeral, this time it's directed by Neil LaBute. It's set on the day an African-American family comes together at the family home to put their beloved husband and father to rest. Now, this is basically a shot-for-shot remake of the original. All of the sight gags are included here. But they're carried out by some serious acting and comic heavyweights. Chris Rock, Martin Lawrence, Danny Glover, Loretta Devine, Tracy Morgan, and they've all ad-libbed their own zingers into the script, none of which I can quote because they all have four-letter words. But Peter Dinklage, he's the only actor to reprise his role from the original version, and his character is allowed more sympathy in the 2010 remake, which I really appreciated. So don't be afraid to watch either version of this film many times. They just get funnier and funnier. But aside from the laughs, Death at a Funeral offers up a message of accepting and loving our family members for who they are and not for what we wish them to be.
You've never met my family.
So last but not least, Brian.
If they can make an American Psycho musical, they can remake any other movie. Okay. I'm just going to say it. I've never seen Sister Act. The only born, what? The only Sister born I've awesome. Ever seen is the one that you showed at the library. I've never seen the Ten Commandments, and I've never seen either version of Death at the Funeral.
Now you know how I feel out. For most podcasts.
I will crawl back to my yurt now.
I thought this was like the easy one where everybody's seen these, so why are we recommending them?
And next month, Crystal will be the host. Okay. So my Groundhog Day pick is Aliens, and I think it came out in 1986. James Cameron. If you don't know the story, Sigourney Weaver and a bunch of space marines go and kill a bunch of aliens, and there's a little girl who's cute, and it's scary. It is actually genuinely very scary. And when I used to watch it all the time on TV when I was a kid, and I was still so scared, even though I'd always watch it on like network TV on a sunny Saturday, so it was like really dark, so I could never see anything anyway, and all the violent parts were cut out, but for some reason it just really, really scared me. And this really cemented my fandom of the Alien franchise, and I just think some of the best action sequences ever are in this movie, and James Cameron can, you know, shoot action sequences better than anyone else. And in particular, there's a part where the Marines go inside the alien tunnels, and it keeps cutting back to their closed circuit TVs, like back on the ship, and it just really, really builds tension really, really well. And I always love that scene, as opposed to action scenes now that are just, I don't know what's happening. There's just like stuff happening on the screen. It's like Stan Brackett's movie or something. I don't get it. Everyone else seemed to like this movie too. It got nominated for 7 different Academy Awards, kind of gone down as a classic. Sigourney Weaver got nominated for Best Actress. That's the first time a sci-fi or a horror movie ever got nominated for an Academy Award for acting. So I love it. So how does this tie into African American History Month? Like Bill, like the Bourne series that Bill's talking about, these are Hollywood movies and they're fun, right? But if it's a Hollywood action movie and there's one black guy, what's going to happen?
Dies first.
He's going to die, right? Okay. So this tradition or this bad stereotype, right, perpetuates itself the whole way through the Alien franchise. So just real quick, in Alien, Yaphet Kotto plays Parker, the wisecracking mechanic. Dies. He's dead, right? It doesn't necessarily die first, but he dies, okay? In Aliens, Al Matthews plays Sergeant Apone, and he's sort of the typical Marine sergeant yelling at his guys, always like chomping on a cigar. He dies, okay? Alien 3, Charles Dutton plays Dylan. Now, he actually has a really big role in the movie, sort of like second build, but at the end, sure enough, dies, okay? Alien Resurrection, Gary Dordan plays Christy. Now, this guy has really cool hair and really cool guns. Guess you know he's going down, right? Come on. Cool hair, cool guns, you're done. You know what I mean? You're just there for flair, right? Like, you're going to get axed off. Okay, Prometheus, Idris Elba plays Janik, and he's like the captain of the ship. But guess what he does? He dies too, right? So everybody dies. Now, of all these, okay, I would say Charles Dutton as Dylan in Alien 3, which I think is a really underrated movie, is the most role. He's really second billed to Sigourney Weaver, and he's like most important to the cast. You could never say that he was token or his character was a stereotype. It was a good movie, and check them all out. And maybe in the next Alien movie, Idris Elba will get to live again. That tends to happen in Alien movies. They come back, or maybe he'll be the Black Bourne. There's always this thing that he's going to be the first Black James Bond. Maybe he'll be the first Black That'd Jason be cool. Bourne. I don't know. He said he was pissed about that, though. He said he doesn't want to be the Black Bond because he'd never be like, what? Oh, Timothy Dalton was the White Bond or something. He'd never say that. So
That's kind of curious because every video game nowadays wants to be aliens, which annoys me. And then I was like, oh, this is why, because this is really good.
Oh, yeah.
I still haven't seen Alien Resurrection, though. Is there any, like,
any you know what? It's like 5 movies in one, like all glommed together, and all the same themes are there.
But is it very Joss Whedon-y? Because probably that was like one of his first movies. Or
there's a little bit of that in there, but like I said, it's like 5 movies all jammed together.
Yeah.
So it's like you get those little Joss Whedon flavors, but there's a lot of other stuff too. Like you can see actually the tension between the Josh sort of factors and the more dark alien like horror things that were normally there. So the movie doesn't really work for that reason. And then hadn't they, even some of the stuff that's happened, like that had been pumped in the other storylines.
Yeah.
One of the things that's interesting about Alien 3 was the production was kind of the same, like 5 different screenwriters and all the studio interference and director replaced and no script.
Yeah, I remember liking it, but it got critically panned big time. Like a lot of people didn't really like 3 as much.
I just think that it's a tight movie, like thematically for how much crap happened around it.
Yeah.
Where if you watch Alien Resurrection, I mean, just watch Dune instead, man.
But I love Dune.
I love Dune too.
I one.
Does that mean you want to go first?
Oh, yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. Well, I was thinking Tickle My Fancy, and there's this writer that I think is sadly has been sadly overlooked, and his books are quickly disappearing from the library. His name is Ross Thompson. He's an American writer of crime fiction. Very quickly, I just want to, what we have still in the collection, I really recommend Chinaman's Chance, Twilight at Mac's Place, Ah Treachery, Briar Patch. His books are witty, smart, totally engrossing. So I'm just campaigning to give Ross Thompson a chance before. We used to have a lot, but they're quickly dwindling down. Just, I don't want him to be forgotten. He's an Edgar Award-winning mystery writer. Probably never heard of him, but he's up in the same league as Elmore Leonard and Ed McBain. So highly recommend Ross Thompson.
And when you say that they're, I forget how you said it, but they're not in the library anymore, that's because folks are not checking them out. So if you are listening and you're like, that sounds great, you need to come and put those books on hold and check them out, and then those books will stay in the library.
What's his name?
Ross Thompson.
Thompson or Thomas?
T-H-O-M-A-S.
Okay, because you said Thompson. And then
I thought you said Thompson.
Ross Thomas.
I wrote down Thomas. I mean Thompson, you're fired. Wait, I said it wrong. I'm fired too.
But start with Chinaman's Chance. Excellent book. You know, if you're not hooked with that one, something wrong with you. But Chinaman's Chance is the one you should really start with. It's considered by a lot of mystery writers to be one of the best.
Is that his first book?
No. His first books, he started out writing under a pseudonym, Oliver Bleak, and he was doing a Cold War. Well, as a matter of fact, his first book was called The Cold War Swap. And so he started, but then he changed for some reason to Ross Thomas.
Now, when Yo Nesbo was on Craig Ferguson, did he mention Ross Thomas?
Jim Thompson is who he highly recommends.
Yeah, Jim Thompson's really good.
Yeah, now he writes that those are the ones that influenced him. And I don't know why he's not. I talked one day to a patron who was really up on the mysteries, and he said, you know, this guy is so much better than some of the others. He even used Robert Ludlum as an example. He said Ludlum couldn't put two sentences together, but this guy can really write. So I'm just recommending him. Ross Thompson.
Thomas.
Groundhog Day.
That's right.
Yeah, it's Ross, you know.
We got it.
Yeah, I think
Brian
we got it now.
Yes, yeah, so I am excited. Because I just found out, like, within the last hour that there's going to be a Chopped cookbook coming out in April. Now, for those of you who listen, know that I watch the Food Network a lot. There's a TV show called Chopped that's hosted by Ted Allen, who is the food guy from the Queer Eye show that was on. So then he went to the Food Network and got this show. And the basic idea is there's four chefs, and they get a basket of four ingredients that are, like, random. Like, it would be cotton candy and scrambled eggs and leftover pizza and green beans. And then you have to make this fabulous appetizer, dessert, or main course, whatever the round you're on. And then for each round, somebody gets chopped. So
literally?
Not literally. Figuratively.
I'd watch that.
There is a butcher knife involved.
That's the Japanese version. Someone actually.
You really, really don't want to lose that one. But yeah, so April, they have a new Chopped cookbook coming out. I think it's like use what you've got to make something great. I don't know more information about that because I just found out about it. But I'm very excited, and I want to go home and watch my mailbox until it comes.
So what's tickling my fancy is this article on the Telegraph, UK, the UK magazine, the Telegraph, and it was called Hatchet Job of the Year Shortlist, and they just have a contest for, like, the most brutal, like, takedown book reviews, and so I'll just put a link to it. Like, they have excerpts of the best lines, and a lot of them are famous books you might have read, including Donna Tartt, which the Goldfinch is, like, most people liked it, but some people really hate it, so it's really hilarious, and I'll link to that.
Like book chopped. I like it.
Tickling My Fancy, this episode, is a rare mid-season addition to Saturday Night Live's cast. The African-American female comic and actress Sasheer Zamata debuts as a featured player. At the time we're recording this podcast, it's this coming Saturday, January 18th. Zamata is like SNL alum Tina Fey, a graduate of University of Virginia. And until her new gig begins, she's a regular performer with the Upright Citizens Brigade. You can go on YouTube to watch some of Zamata's stand-up and other comic work. She's super smart, insightful, and talented. I keep watching SNL because I adore sketch comedy, and I've been watching it for years. But the show just hasn't been consistently funny in a long time. And I sincerely hope that Zamata's talents are showcased and not wasted. Getting less press, but an important step nonetheless, is a mid-season addition of two writers to the SNL team. That's Lakendra Tookes and Leslie Jones. Both are African-American females. And if you want to know more, I recommend reading an essay published at Slate.com by Tanner Colby. It's called SNL's Real Race Problem. And we're going to link to it in the show notes. All right, let's tickle in your fancy this episode.
Well, I'm tickled that one of those writers has the same name as my sister, Leslie Jones.
Nice.
Freaky.
Maybe it is your sister and she just didn't tell you.
She's kept one really big secret for her entire life.
She's just really funny.
I had no idea. Yeah. Well played. I thought that tickling my fancy this month would be a couple of things that you could do around town. That's right. And by you, I mean me. In the month of February. The Bell Court is showing a retrospective of some past Best Picture winners. And on February 14th through the 16th, they're showing Casablanca, whatever. It is awesome. Wartime romance slash action slash comedy slash it's one of those rare movies where it's got another one of those zillions of writers who put their hands in the pot but actually turned out really good. And then on February 22nd through the 23rd, they're showing Amadeus.
Not that Amadeus.
Rob me Amadeus.
I wanted to show Litzomania.
And I really liked it. You know, it's one of my favorite movies. I really liked the whole, like, you know, everybody has that one person who does whatever they like really effortlessly. And that kind of, like, you know, simmering jealousy and Salieri kind of goes a little too far. And then at the Frist Center, starting on February 28th, they're showing Goya, The Disasters of War. Francisco Goya's paintings or I think it's etchings or drawings, whatever.
Art.
Two-dimensional representations of the Peninsular War campaign during the Napoleonic Wars. And it's supposed to be I've seen some of them and they're really kind of graphic and kind of gross. And
Goya tickles my fancy.
Really excited
to
see them.
But wait, you don't do art at museums.
Are
you making an exception for Goya? Did he crack your wall?
We get a discount.
I want to say something snarky about the Frist not having a permanent collection, but there's a little man in my head that says, no, you shouldn't say that.
It's an alien.
So I won't say that.
I've never been to the Frist.
Pretty cool. So they converted Art Deco, whatever. And lastly, I was going to mention that they're also starting a really big exhibition at the same place, the Frist, the aforementioned Frist, called Looking East, Western Artists and the Allure of Japan, starting on January 31st and extending until May 11th, featuring works by Edgar Degas, Vincent van Gogh, Claude Monet,
Van Gogh,
Edvard Munch, and some furniture by Frank Lloyd Wright.
Those are all very Japanese artists, yes.
Yeah, you know. And
their samurai swords out, go to it.
You know, some of those paintings they show on the website don't look Japanese at all, especially that the Van Gogh painting is like a sailor, you know, like, you know, a French sailor with the beard and stuff. But, you know,
with maybe French flag.
You know, maybe he was he went to Japan and was like, you know, it's très bien. I don't know. But it sounds pretty cool and I'll totally be there.
I love the Frist. I go there. The it's one museum that I go to is the Frist. It's a beautiful building. You should go there just to check out the building. It's cool.
I drive by it. I wave.
It's cool.
I do think it is a little weird, though, there isn't a permanent collection. Because I remember going there. I'm like, wait, there's no – really? It's all like traveling and, you know, stuff across the country.
I think that the arts community in Nashville knows that. But some rich person has to die and then – we'll make that a reality.
Well, Robert Redford's working on it.
He's not going to leave because he's mad at me. Exactly. Robert Redford's mad at me. So it's going to go to Chattanooga. It's going to get that museum.
They've got an aquarium. They don't need an art museum.
Can I tell my Ten Commandments joke?
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Okay. This is supposedly Well, they said it wasn't true, but it should be true. We'll just say this actually happened. While they were filming The Ten Commandments, Cecil B. DeMille was shooting the Exodus scene, you know, when he had like 10, 20,000 extras. This is way before the days of computer-generated effects.
CGI extras.
Yeah, so these were actual extras. And so they had three cameras set up to capture this moment. So he yells, CB yells action, Cecil B. DeMille yells action, or he's better known as CB, and said after the scene was over with, he yelled cut, and he got on the walkie-talkie. Camera one, what'd you get? CB, I'm sorry, nothing but dust. Camera two, CB, I'm sorry, the camera jammed. Camera three, ready when you are, CB. That's my Ten Commandments joke.
I don't have one of those, but I wanted to ask you guys, before we run out of time, if you've ever heard of something called hate watching.
Or you watch something you don't like on purpose to say you can, like, rag on it. I've
heard
about that.
Why I've never actually done it. Music Live on TV.
Okay, so I was reading about this on the Scenes Country Life blog, and it was about this. I guess people do this. You watch a show that you hate just so you can make jokes about it on social media while you're watching it. And
I didn't know it had an actual term.
Yeah, I didn't know it had a name either. But it was funny because the hook in the story was, how long is it going to be before producers just make a show to make that happen? Like, intentionally make a bad show that everyone will hate so people can hate watch. But if you're watching it, they don't care why, right? And if you're writing about it on social media, they don't care, right?
Sharknado the series.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't that Sharknado?
Now, they're going to redo another musical next year, so something to look forward to.
Here's the kicker, though. I buried the lead a little bit.
Oh,
so
exciting.
The show that they were writing about is a new reality show set in Nashville about music hopefuls. And they're like, if there ever was a show that would be made for hate watching on purpose, it would be this show. Ooh. Who is Burl Ives?
Well, he won the Academy Award for The Big Country, and he's also noted as a folk singer.
He was Frosty the Snowman.
Yeah, I was about to say he was Frosty the Snowman, right?
And he was Big Daddy and Cat in the Hot Tin Roof.
This is an actor and singer, and he did Frosty the Snowman and won an Academy Award for
The Big Country.
Okay, cool. Because, you know, I've pretended like I know who he is, but I don't really know who he is.
My dad liked him.
Frosty the Snowman. Did he do anything else?
Peter Cottontail? Know.
He has a whole album
Peter
of songs.
Cottontail, too.
He did a lot of songs. Okay. What was I going to say? If you want more info, where can you go?
www.
Library.
Oh, you forgot the dot.
Oh, fine. Whatever. Like, okay. Period.
You just totally confused some low-tech person. I don't know how they got to the podcast.
Why?
Welcome.
Why?
Thanks for joining us. It's been fun.
www.library. Brary.
Dot.
Nashville.
Dot.
Org. Or as Bill says.
Not saying it.
Just Google it.
Google it.
Oh, yeah, Google it.
Accepting this, I protest.
That's right.